So, it's my pleasure to introduce Christopher McIntosh, who's been at many of the esoteric ones, since including the very first one in Chesky Cromwell. A very beautiful talk that he gave in Chesky Cromwell was included in the book. Actually, I haven't mentioned that a book came out of the first two conferences. The first one in Chesky Cromwell, the Rosicrucian Enlightenment Revisited, and then the second one, Prague, Alchemy, and the Hermetic Tradition. So I remember Christopher gave the concluding talk in Chesky Cromwell, and it was a beautiful presentation. Christopher is the author of many books. He's really a writer and scholar specializing in the esoteric traditions. He teaches at the University of Exeter in the Center for the Study of Esotericism there. He just has had a brand new novel just published called The Return of the Tetrad. I won't try to list all his titles, I'll just mention a few. The Rose Cross and the Age of Reason. The Swan King, Ludwig of Bavaria, and of course, Gardens of the Gods, on which his workshop earlier in the week was based. So it's wonderful to have Christopher with us. It's always a pleasure. He's an integral part of our Esoteric Quest community. In fact, as you may remember, as I mentioned, he's the person who actually named it the Esoteric Quest when we were trying to think of what to call the Esoteric Quest or the conference, the moving conference that we did in Central Europe. And from the Renaissance Bohemia to Goethe's Weimar, it was Christopher who said, why not call it an esoteric class in Central Europe? And so we're very grateful to him for that. But we're also grateful to him for another reason, which, as you may remember, I said that initially I invited Nicholas Goodrich Clark, who was the professor of esotericism at Exeter University and really the founder of this center for the study, one of only three chairs in the world, and the only one in the English-speaking world. I'd asked Christopher, Nicholas, to do this talk. And he was filled with enthusiasm. He'd been fascinated by Frederick since he was a boy, and had maintained that fascination throughout his life. And he sent me an email, a page-long email, but it was bursting with ideas. There was a book in that email. Yeah, there were so many levels of esoteric connection. Then, as you know, tragically, he died this year. It's a really sad development. And then his wife, or widow, at the time, I don't even know how to say the word widow, Claire, was going to come and join us. As you know, I speak about Hildegard of Bingen to give us a picture of 12th century European spirituality, but she sprained her ankle. And you can imagine with the amount of walking we've had to do, not to mention to get from Devon to Syracuse and back, it was really not feasible for her to come. But Nicholas and Claire certainly live deeply in our hearts, and I know Christopher's going to say just a few words about that. So let's welcome Christopher McIntosh. It's great to have him.
Society to meet periodically and talk about broadly esoteric things. And we used to meet in various pubs around Soho and Bloomsbury and Maida Vale. And I think it's fair to say that that society helped to lay the foundation for the study of esotericism as an academic field. And of course, Nicholas went on to found the Exeter Center for the Study of Esotericism, where I've been teaching since it was founded about 8 years ago. Now, when I was asked to give this talk in Nick's absence, I felt rather daunted because the subject of Frederick II is so enormous that we could easily spend this entire conference just talking about him. So where should I begin? Well, let me begin by asking you to exercise your imaginations. I'd like to take you back to the year 1240 and ask you to imagine that you are traveling to the court of Frederick II as part of a delegation from King Henry III of England, whose sister Isabella is married to the Emperor. The purpose of your visit is to give the Emperor some gifts from King Henry, including a pair of English falcons, some rare astrological manuscripts, a Celtic harp made of rosewood, some English longbows made of yew, a splendid suit of armor made in the royal armory, and many other precious gifts. Well, by that time, Frederick has moved his capital from Palermo to Foggia on the mainland. There. So, you sail to the port of Salerno. You were met by a representative of the Emperor and a Saracen cavalry escort, because the Saracens form an elite contingent in Frederick's army. You're escorted to some carriages while servants load your gifts onto another carriage which follows behind. Then you make a 3-day journey across the peninsula through mountainous countryside, passing farms, vineyards, and many ancient Greek and Roman ruins. Finally, you come to Foggia, and you pass under the great portal of the Emperor's palace, which you see there on the right. It's unfortunately the only remnant of the palace still there. You're escorted through a courtyard and up a stairway to a magnificent bedroom painted with beautiful murals. After you've rested a while from your journey, someone reappears to escort you to the Emperor. And as you are ushered through the endless corridors of the palace, you grow more and more keyed up as you recall everything you've heard about the Emperor. Here is a man who rules over vast territories, stretching from the Holy Land to northern Germany, who has already been twice excommunicated by the Pope, but who has refused to submit, who has made himself King of Jerusalem, placing the crown on his own head in defiance of the Pope's ban, who speaks at least 6 languages, who possesses enormous learning and an insatiable thirst for knowledge, who shows great tolerance towards his Jewish and Muslim subjects, although not towards Christian heretics, curiously enough. He didn't like Christian heretics. But he can be open-hearted and generous, but also ruthless and violent and vindictive and sometimes unbelievably cruel. So this is the man they call Stupor Mundi, the marvel of the world. And this is the man you see when you enter the throne room and you walk with the other members of your delegation between a long row of courtiers towards the emperor's throne. Now, perhaps you had expected him to look something like this, which is how he was romanticized in the 19th century. Whereas, in fact, he probably looked more like this. Also an artist's impression, but probably more accurate. This is taken from his book on folk country, De Arte Venandi. But at any rate, he's not quite as intimidating as you expect. He's a man in his mid-40s of medium height, with reddish hair, a reddish complexion, and an authoritative bearing. He receives you in a friendly manner, examines with delight the presents that your delegation has brought, thanks you graciously, and then invites you to dinner. Everyone then processes behind the emperor into a great dining hall, where a long table has been laid for 200 people, with the emperor at the head. The room is lit by many torches held in brackets around the walls. At one end is a gallery where a small orchestra is playing a variety of instruments. Harps, lutes, dulcimers, flutes, trumpets, and bagpipes. A splendid feast is served, which wine flows in abundance. And when the feast is finished, the main entertainment begins. There are jugglers, fire eaters, jesters, and acrobats. And at one point, three young Saracen girls come into the room, balancing on brightly colored balls, which they skillfully maneuver with their feet. There are also some animals from the emperor's large menagerie, monkeys, parrots, and a cheetah lying on the floor, gnawing at a piece of meat. Finally, the emperor bids everyone good night, and you retire to your room. So ends your first encounter with Frederick II. So who was this Frederick II, this marvel of the world? A bit about his background. First, it's important to realize that through his parents, he was heir to two great dynasties. On his father's side, he was heir to the German Empire, that is to say, the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation, founded by Charlemagne 400 years earlier. His father was the Emperor Henry VI, and his grandfather was the legendary Emperor Barbarossa, Frederick Barbarossa, of whom legend has it that he's not dead but asleep in a cavern in the Harz Mountains, and that one day he's going to wake up and return to the throne. Their dynasty was called the Hohenstaufen dynasty, after the Hohenstaufen castle in Swabia, which was their ancestral seat. It's no longer there, but this is a medieval drawing of it. Frederick's mother was Constance of Sicily, granddaughter of King Roger II, one of the Norman dynasty that ruled Sicily for about a century. The circumstances of his birth were rather strange. He was born at Vesi in central Italy. His mother was around 40 at the time, and some people thought that she was too old to give birth to an heir. So to forestall these suspicions, she had a tent erected in the main square of Vesi, and she invited the wives of various dignitaries of the town to be there and witness the birth. Frederick's Norman heritage was extremely important for him, so let me say a bit about it. As we learned from Leonard Cervelli yesterday, the Norman conquest of southern Italy began around the end of the 10th century when Norman adventurers came to the region, first as mercenaries and then as conquerors who over time established a series of Norman fiefdoms which gradually merged into one unified state, first as a dukedom under Roger I, whom you see here. This is obviously a later artist's impression, but you see him here receiving the keys of Palermo from the outgoing Muslim ruler. He was succeeded by his son Simon, who in turn was succeeded by his brother Roger II, under whom Sicily became a kingdom that comprised not only the island of Sicily, but the whole southern half of the Italian peninsula. This whole area was what was called the Kingdom of Sicily. It was an area of mixed population, especially the island itself, combining Norman, Italian, Greek, Arab, Jewish, and other elements. Earlier, the island had been ruled by the Muslims, as we heard yesterday. Then, with Roger II, the kingdom came under Christian rulership, but Roger wisely interfered as little as possible with the various communities. For example, he employed Muslim officials in his administration. He and his successors were keen to promote the intellectual and cultural life of the kingdom, drawing on the best elements from the Latin West, the Arab world in the south, and the Byzantine Empire in the east. One has to remember that the Byzantine Empire had its own church and its own patriarch and its own rich culture. And there was a lot of Byzantine influence in the Sicilian kingdom in terms of learning, culture, art, architecture, and so on. And also under the Normans, there was the great medical school at Salerno on the mainland, and the monastery of Monte Cassino, one of the greatest centers of learning in Europe at that time, with a vast library embracing all the arts and sciences. And it was under the Normans that the court of Palermo really came into its own as a vibrant cultural center and a crossroads of many cultural influences. You can see that when you go into the chapel of the Norman Palace at Palermo, the Cappella Palatina. The ground plan is Roman. The mosaics are Byzantine. The sculpture is Norman. And the ceramic tiles are Arabic. Well, to return to Frederick, soon after his birth in 1194, he was crowned King of Sicily. But his life had hardly begun before he became an orphan. He lost his father when he was nearly three, and his mother a year later. He then came under the guardianship of Pope Innocent III, who also acted as regent while Frederick was growing up. He grew up in an atmosphere of intense political intrigue and conflict. His title as King of Sicily was disputed by another branch of his mother's family. The country had no central control. It was seen of continual warring between various feudal barons, and at one point, one of these barons. And all the time, the Pope, his guardian, was using him as a pawn in his attempt to extend papal control in Sicily. Meanwhile, in Germany, where Frederick had a claim to the title of emperor, the princes had instead given their allegiance to his uncle, Philip of Swabia. So it was an extremely difficult role that he had inherited. And he must have been very much aware of that throughout his childhood. The the age of 14, Frederick officially assumed the kingship and the Pope's regency ended. By this time, he had developed into a very well-rounded youth. He was physically enormously strong and robust. He had become a skilled swordsman, archer, and rider. At the same time, he had acquired a very good education from various tutors. He was an eager student and had that hunger for knowledge that he retained throughout his life. Altogether, he learned at least 6 languages: Latin, Sicilian, German, French, Greek, and Arabic. When he was 15, through the mediation of the Pope, he married Princess Constance of Aragon, who was 10 years older than he was. Now, remember that in those days, kings and princes didn't marry for love. Marriage was a means of forging alliances and gaining territory. Nevertheless, the marriage appears to have been a happy one and lasted 13 years until Constance's death. In the same year as his marriage, he won his first military victory when he subdued the northeastern part of Sicily. From then on, he was almost constantly at war. Now, here one has to remember that if you were a king, and especially if you were an emperor, then war was your business. You always had enemies who contested your power or wanted your territory. And if you weren't fighting these enemies, you were considered weak. So Frederick's reign was one long succession of military campaigns. At the same time, in between these campaigns, he found time for the enormous cultural and social achievements for which he is remembered. From the point of view of today, this may seem paradoxical, but in fact there are many examples from other times and places of how a society marked by violence and conflict could produce high culture. Another example would be the Japan of the Shogunate, again a cruel and violent age, but one that produced an abundance of beautiful art, architecture, poetry, landscape gardening, and so on. Before coming to Frederick's cultural achievements, I'd like to give an overall picture of his reign. As I said, Frederick was heir to the Kingdom of Sicily and to the German Empire, which you see here in this map, stretching from the North Sea right down to northern Italy. He inherited from his grandfather, Frederick Barbarossa, and his father, Henry VI, a vision of empire, which he then carried further. Basically, he saw his empire as a continuation of the old Roman Empire. For example, he had beautiful gold coins minted, showing his profile, portrayed as a Roman emperor. And he commissioned various archaeological excavations to uncover Roman remains. So he saw his empire as a universal Christian empire, with himself as the supreme monarch, answerable to God alone. But this was not the way the Pope saw it. The Pope saw the empire as a theocracy, with himself as the supreme authority, and the emperor as subservient to the papacy. The Pope was also the ruler of the papal territories in central Italy, with his own army, and he was eager to extend his kingdom. He also wanted to prevent the emperor from getting too powerful, and he was against the union of Sicily and Germany, between which the papal states were waged. So the Pope had strong doctrinal and geopolitical ambitions, which were bound to conflict with the aims of Frederick. However, at first, Frederick's relations with the Pope were reasonably good. Pope Innocent III supported Frederick's claim to the imperial crown. Frederick was crowned King of Germany at Mainz at the age of 18 in the year 1212. He then went on a triumphal tour through southern Germany, where he was cheered by the people and the princes as the bright young star who was going to usher in a bright new era for the empire. Staying on in Germany to consolidate his position there, he arrived in 1212 at Aachen, the former capital of Charlemagne, and was crowned again in the cathedral. After the coronation service, he did what was known as taking the cross, which meant taking a vow to go on a crusade to the Holy Land. 5 years later, in 1220, he went to Rome, where he was crowned Holy Roman Emperor by the Pope. He then moved his capital to Foggia on the mainland, but continued to move back and forth between the mainland and the island of Sicily, as he concentrated on consolidating his rule and setting his mark on his kingdom. He established a strong central administration and a legal code. He founded the University of Naples with a wide curriculum, including law, philosophy, and the natural sciences, and interestingly, providing stipendiums for foreign students. He also passed laws concerning his non-Christian subjects. Jews were permitted to live in the kingdom, but they had to wear distinctive clothes, and the men had to grow beards. Incidentally, Frederick was always very fair and very respectful towards his Jewish subjects. This is shown by an incident that took place at Hagenau in Germany around 1235, during his second visit to Germany. A Christian boy had allegedly been murdered by the Jews of that region. And Frederick was called upon to pass judgment. So he created a commission of princes, nobles, clergy, and other worthies to consider the charges. But he found that they produced conflicting evidence and couldn't advise him adequately. So he then sent for Jewish converts to Christianity from all over Europe, men who were learned in Jewish law. They reported that the Hebrew scriptures forbade the shedding of human blood. So Frederick pronounced in favor of the Jews and forbade anyone to make such charges against them in the future. Well, this is one of the many examples of how much he was ahead of his time. At that time, it was very rare for a case against Jews to be tried objectively on the basis of the evidence. So Frederick's judgment set an important precedent and was to have wide repercussions in the way that Jews were treated. As for his Saracen subjects, these presented a problem as they dominated the mountainous regions of Sicily and were constantly fighting with their Christian neighbors. Frederick's solution was to move some 16,000 of them to Lucera in Apulia in central Italy, as Alessandra mentioned earlier. Here they were given farmland and allowed to live in peace. As I said, many of them were drafted into his army and proved very brave and loyal soldiers. But this Saracen colony was a thorn in the flesh of the Pope, who didn't like having a colony of Muslims on Italian soil. The Pope was also pressing Frederick to fulfill his promise to go on a crusade. Well, finally, in 1227, Frederick at last prepared to embark on his crusade. And this was really what brought his conflict with the papacy to a head, because just as he was about to set off, he came down with the plague, of which many people were dying at the time. So he decided to cancel his voyage and sent a message to the Pope explaining the decision. The Pope was furious and sent a message back excommunicating him on the grounds that he had broken his crusading vow. The Pope in question was Gregory the Ninth. Gregory the Ninth, who was fanatical in his insistence on the supremacy of the papacy, and probably he hoped to use the excommunication as a way of bringing down his rival, the Emperor Frederick. Now that he was excommunicated, Frederick was banned by the Church from going on a further crusade. He ignored the ban, and in June 1228, finally sailed from Brindisi for the Holy Land with a body of troops with the intention of retaking Jerusalem. Meanwhile, he had married Princess Isabella of Brienne, heiress to the Kingdom of Jerusalem through her father, John of Brienne. Frederick promptly pushed John aside and claimed the crown of Jerusalem for himself. But first he had to retake Jerusalem from the Saracens under their leader Al-Kamil, Sultan of Egypt, whom you see here in a famous meeting that he had with Francis of Assisi. Again, this is an artist's impression. However, instead of going to war against Al-Kamil, Frederick entered into delicate negotiations with him through ambassadors, helped by his fluent commands of Arabic. Here you see a meeting between Frederick and the Sultan. Frederick on the left, the Sultan in the middle. Curiously enough, they look rather alike. But this is again an artist's impression, and we don't know if they actually met. The interesting thing is that whenever the negotiations became bogged down, Frederick would start asking the Sultan's ambassador deep questions about Arabic science and mathematics, which were relayed to the Sultan, who in turn passed them on to his learned scholars. So in this way, Frederick established a rapport with the Saracens, and finally the Sultan agreed to hand over Jerusalem to the Christians and sign a 10-year truce. Under the terms of the agreement, the Muslim population were to be left in peace and could retain their holy sites. After the agreement, this was what the Kingdom of Jerusalem looked like. A thin strip of land along the coast, connected by a corridor with Jerusalem and Bethlehem. The Pope was furious at this agreement, because he took the view the Crusaders weren't there to negotiate with the Saracens, they were there to shed Saracen blood, kill as many as possible. And he became even more furious when Frederick went to Jerusalem, entered the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and placed the crown on his own head. Then, left with his prestige enormously enhanced, he hurried back to Sicily. And not a moment too soon, because Sicily was once again driven by conflict, and large areas had been invaded by papal troops and the troops of his former father-in-law, John of Brienne, his wife Isabella having died a year earlier. He first restored order in Sicily, drove out the papal armies, then made his peace with Pope Gregory, who rather reluctantly lifted the excommunication, although Frederick was to be excommunicated again later on. But Frederick was now secure enough, at least for a time, to turn his mind to non-military matters. I say for a time, because he was to be embroiled in many future wars, and his conflict with the papacy was to flare up again. But for the moment, he was free to turn to other things. So I'll now concentrate on his remarkable contributions to the civilization of his age. Frederick loved the world of learning and said that if he had had a choice, he would rather have been a philosopher than an emperor and warlord. So he now turned his court into a vibrant center of learning, culture, and the arts. One of the things that made it such a vibrant place and such a key center in the history of European civilization was that it was a crossroads between Europe and the Middle East. Remember that this was a pivotal time in Europe with the exposure to Jewish and Arabic learning. And the rediscovery of classical philosophers like Aristotle, whose works had been preserved in Arabic by scholars such as the Andalusian Muslim scholar Averroes, who's a statue of whom we see here, who also wrote his own commentaries on Aristotle. When these Arabic versions of Aristotle were translated into Latin, the impact on Europe was enormous and led to what is called the scholastic movement, that is the incorporation of classical philosophy into Christian theology with people like Thomas Aquinas and others. Also, apart from Arabic sources, came works on medicine, astronomy, mathematics, and other sciences, which also had a huge influence in Europe. A key figure in the transmission of Arab learning to Europe, as Alessandro mentioned, was Michael Scott, one of Frederick's closest associates and a regular frequenter of the imperial court. Michael was a lowland Scot and an ordained priest, a man of enormous learning who had traveled widely, including to Spain, where he acquired a knowledge of Arabic, which enabled him to translate the works of Aristotle from Arabic into Latin, along with the commentaries of Averroes. These translations of Michael Scott were absolutely key to the transmission of Aristotelian thought to Europe. So for that reason alone, he would be an important figure. But this was only one of his achievements. He was also well-versed in theology, mathematics, zoology, astronomy, astrology, and alchemy. In fact, virtually every branch of knowledge of the time. He was also reputedly a magician. Although he condemns demonic magic, his works are full of magical information, such as the occult properties of certain words, herbs, and precious stones, and the conjurations appropriate to different hours of the day and night. For this reason, Dante, in his Divine Comedy, consigns him to the eighth circle of hell, reserved for sorcerers, astrologers, and false prophets. Michael Scott was important to Frederick in all sorts of ways. First of all, as an astrologer and the author of a work on astrology, which greatly influenced Frederick. Here you see a page from a manuscript of this work showing the sun, a figure driving a chariot representing the sun. In the preface to this work, Michael Scott wrote that the signs of planets are not the first movers or first causes and do not themselves confer aught of good or evil, but by their motion do indicate something of truth concerning every body produced in this corruptible world. Well, that's in fact a very sophisticated view of astrology for its time, and it's similar to Carl Gustav Jung's view that astrology works through synchronicity. At any rate, Frederick, like many men of his time, believed in astrology and took no important action without consulting the stars. A famous example of this is how when he married his first wife, Isabella of England, he postponed sleeping with her until the moment when the stars were propitious for intercourse, according to the astrologers. Michael Scott was also a proponent of physiognomy, the science of reading people's character from their facial features and voices. He wrote a book on this subject, The Physiognomia, dedicated to the emperor, who used this rather doubtful science to detect the virtues and vices of the people around him, increasingly so towards the end of his reign. And this must have often led to false conclusions about people. Michael also wrote books on palmistry and alchemy. But above all, it was Michael's encyclopedic mind that Frederick so much valued. Frederick had an insatiable thirst for knowledge about the workings of the universe and was continually putting questions to Michael. How far is it to the most remote heaven? Where are paradise, hell, and purgatory located? How big is the earth? What holds it in space? How many stars are there in the heavens? What are the distances between them? What is the composition of seawater and fresh water? What causes winds and volcanic eruptions? He composed long lists of such questions, and addressed them not only to Michael Scott, but also to, especially after Michael's death, around 1232, to various scholars in other countries, the great Andalusian Sufi philosopher Ibn Sabin. As Alessandra mentioned in her talk, Ibn Sabin wrote a whole treatise in reply called The Sicilian Questions. Frederick also put similar questions to the great Jewish philosopher Judah ben Solomon Cohen and others. But probably the most important scholar that he was in touch with was the great mathematician Leonardo of Pisa, better known as Fibonacci, whom Scott told us about yesterday. Fibonacci, who gave his name to the Fibonacci series of numbers, and most importantly, played a key role in bringing the decimal system to Europe. Sorry, that's a page from a manuscript by Michael Scott, the Liber Particularis. Here's Leonardo of Pisa, known as Fibonacci. So Fibonacci gave his name to the Fibonacci series of numbers and brought the decimal system to Europe, or at least played a leading role in doing so. Fibonacci grew up partly in Bougia near Algiers, where his father ran a business trading with the Arabs. And here the young Leonardo learned the Arabic system of calculation, which had originally come from India, using the decimal point. Now, previously in Europe, calculations were done using Roman numerals, which was extremely cumbersome, especially when it came to fractions. Fibonacci realized the enormous advantages of the Indo-Arabic system, and at the age of about 30, he traveled around the Mediterranean, studying with the leading Arab mathematicians of the day. Then he came back to Italy, and at the age of 32, published his Liber Abaci, which virtually launched the decimal system in Europe. Frederick must have known about Fibonacci from his childhood, but they met for the first time in Pisa, where Frederick had a palace, when Frederick was in his early 30s and Fibonacci around 50. And they had a learned discussion about mathematics, and probably continued to correspond after that meeting. One of the things they must have discussed was the golden section, which is built into the Fibonacci series of numbers, as Scott told us. This is the ratio of 1 to 1.618, which runs through all of nature. It's in the proportions of the human body, in the nautilus shell, in the petals of flowers, in the DNA molecule, and it's also found everywhere in classical and medieval architecture. So, not surprisingly, Frederick used this proportion in some of his buildings. The most striking example being Castel del Monte in Apulia, near the heel of Italy, built in the 1240s. Now, there's been a lot of speculation about this building. It's too small to have been much use as a fortress. And furthermore, the spiral staircases in it go up anti-clockwise. This meant that the people defending the castle would have been at a disadvantage, because if you're holding a sword in your right hand, the central pillar of the spiral staircase is on the right, so you continue being hampered by the pillar. Whereas the attackers have an advantage, because the pillar is on the left and they wield the sword much more easily. So for that reason alone, it seems unlikely that it was a fortress. It doesn't look much like a hunting lodge, which some people think it was. So what was it? Well, let's look at the geometry of the building and see if it gives us any clues. The basic template is four rectangles superimposed like this. Each of these rectangles is a golden rectangle, that is to say the sides are in the proportion of the golden section. Possibly this was Fibonacci's influence at work. This gives you an octagonal plan, and by joining up the outer points and adding towers at the corners, you get the grand plan of Castel del Monte. Everything is eightfold. There are eight sides, eight large rooms, and eight octagonal towers. What I'm going to say now has a bearing on Greg's question about whether Frederick was a Sufi or not. The octagon is a sacred figure in Islam. There are eight divisions of the Muslim heaven, and Islamic buildings are often built in octagonal form. A well-known example is the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, which had greatly impressed Frederick when he was there on his crusade. The octagonal form was also used for mausolea. Consider, for example, the tomb of the Sufi saint Rukn-i-Alam at Multan in Pakistan, built in the 1330s. Now, compare the ground plan of this tomb with the ground plan of Castel del Monte. They are almost identical. Now, admittedly, the tomb of Rukn-i-Alam is later in date, but it was obviously built according to a traditional plan. So could it have been that Frederick intended Castel del Monte as a mausoleum? Or, if we want to speculate even further, could it have been that he was a Sufi sympathizer, or maybe even a secret Sufi? That this, of course, is wild speculation, and there's absolutely no evidence for it, but This is certainly very striking, and it raises that question. Why did he build Castel del Monte in that form? Well, in the end, as we know, he was buried in Palermo. And we also know that the octagonal form is found in the Christian world, for example, the imperial crown, which would have been placed on his head by the Pope, and also has eight sides. That, as I say, that doesn't account for the striking similarity between Castel del Monte and the design of those Sufi tombs. But I'll leave the question open why he chose that form. Castel del Monte was only one of many castles built by Frederick throughout Sicily and the mainland. Here is Castello Ursino in Catania, which Frederick built when he was consolidating his power on the island. And Castello Maniaci right taught to us here. This was originally built 2 centuries earlier, but it was rebuilt under Frederick. It was later given by the then King of Sicily to the British Admiral Nelson, and was then inherited by his relations, the Bridport family, who occupied it until 1982, when it was given to the province of Catania. Here is Prato in Tuscany, and here's another castle, Largo Pozzuoli near Potenza, in the arch of the Boot of Italy. This castle really was used as a hunting lodge, that is, hunting with falcons. And that brings us to the subject of falconry, on which Frederick was one of the greatest experts of his age, and on which he wrote a famous treatise, which is still regarded as one of the standard works on the subject, De arte venandi cum avibus, the art of hunting with birds. Falconry is traditionally the sport of kings and nobles. It's an extremely complex and difficult art. You have to know the different species of falcon, what kinds of prey they hunt, in what kind of terrain, and you have to know how to train a falcon to fetch the prey and bring it back to you. The Arabs had early on developed falconry to a fine art. So again, it was to the Arab world that Frederick turned when collecting material for his treatise. He spent some 30 years gathering knowledge about falconry from all over the Arab world, and finally he put it together in a book in the 1240s. The original manuscript is lost. This is a French copy of a copy, but we can assume that the illustrations are fairly true to the original. Now, this work is extremely significant in a number of ways. It was not only the first really comprehensive treatise on falconry outside the Arab world, but it also contains a whole section about ornithology in general, and it set a whole new standard in the study of natural history, and in fact scientific writing in general. Up to that point, Aristotle had been the great authority on the world of nature. Frederick knew Aristotle's work very well, but what he relied upon, above all, was the evidence of careful, precise observation and reason. And this led him to reject many of Aristotle's assertions. For example, Aristotle had maintained that in a flock of geese, it's the most intelligent goose, the cry flies at the front, at the tip of the arrow-shaped formation. Whereas Frederick observed that in fact, take it in turns to occupy this position, because that is where the wind resistance is strongest. And there were other points where he proved Aristotle wrong. Now this was a key moment in Western thought when the supreme monarch of Christian Europe challenged the authority of the previously unassailable Aristotle. On Friday, Leonard George talked about how Empedocles had the idea of evolution and how Aristotle prevented it from being accepted, because Aristotle insisted that the species were fixed. So Aristotle had become an unchallenged authority in the medieval Christian world. And this was the first time that he had been seriously challenged by an eminent monarch. So Frederick's book marked a turning point in Western thought by showing that Aristotle could get things wrong. And furthermore, it's the only pioneering scientific treatise by a medieval monarch. It's an amazing achievement. In the light of everything else that Frederick was doing at the time, his military campaigns, his struggles for the papacy, his administrative reforms, and so on. Unfortunately, Frederick's scientific curiosity sometimes led him to conduct cruel and inhumane experiments. For example, at one point he wanted to explore the idea that there's an original language of man, and he had two small children brought up in such a way that no one spoke to them. And eventually the children died. On another occasion, he had a man locked up in a barrel until he died to see whether one could observe the soul leaving the body, and things like that. And that was an example of how he had a cruel streak, and he treated his enemies, the people who opposed him, often with absolute barbaric cruelty. But to return to his cultural achievements, there was another sphere in which Frederick made his mark, and that was poetry. Frederick was not only a patron of poets, but he also wrote poetry himself. In poetry, as in other areas, Sicilian form of the vernacular had become the main language of communication, alongside Latin, which was used for more official purposes. There were also areas of Greek population where Greek was still spoken, both on the island of Sicily and on the mainland. The period of Frederick's reign coincided with the high point of the troubadour tradition. German counterpart, the Minnesang, the tradition of courtly love poetry. How this tradition arose is a bit of a mystery. Right at the height of the patriarchal Middle Ages, poets began to write about how a knight or courtier would offer a noble lady his unconditional love and devotion, and would go out and do heroic deeds in her service, expecting nothing in return, and indeed rejoicing in the suffering that he endured when the love was unfulfilled. And this tradition gave rise to a whole movement of poetry and song, the troubadour movement, which flourished above all in Provence, and the favored language was Occitan, the form of French spoken in the south. It was also the time of the great epics about the court of King Arthur and his knights, and the quest for the Holy Grail, like the works of the French poet Chrétien de Troyes and Wolfram von Eschenbach with his great epic Parsifal. These also penetrated to Sicily, and Frederick may have been influenced by the Arthurian concept of knighthood, because in the constitution that he drew up, he gave a specially exalted position to the knights of his court. He called them the foundation of all dignity. He also gave an honored position to the many poets who frequented his court. The early years of Frederick's reign coincided with the Albigensian Crusade in southern France, a campaign to extinguish the Cathar movement, a campaign which devastated the region and caused a diaspora of troubadours, many of whom sought refuge in Sicily, bringing an enriching influence to Sicilian poetry. So Frederick's court was a literary melting pot, and what came out of it had a profound influence outside Sicily. First of all, the language developed there, the Sicilian vernacular, spread to all of Italy and became the standard Italian literary vernacular. Furthermore, one of the poets at Frederick's court, Giacomo da Lentini, invented the poetic form known as the sonnet, a poem of 14 lines with a particular metric structure. It was later adopted by Dante and Petrarch, and then taken up by poets in many other countries, including Shakespeare. So if it hadn't been for Frederick's court, we might not have Shakespeare's sonnets. I'll skip fairly quickly over the last years of Frederick's life, which were marked by continuing battles against the papacy and against his enemies in the northern Italian states. He suffered a heavy defeat at the Battle of Parma in 1248 and was just beginning to recover his fortunes when he died unexpectedly at Castel Fiorentino near Foggia in his 56th year. His body was transported to Palermo and placed in this sarcophagus in the cathedral. He was succeeded by his son Conrad, but Conrad was deposed and decapitated a few years later, and that was the end of the dynasty. How are we to assess Frederick? Let me quote two contrasting descriptions of him. Here's how his bitter enemy, Pope Gregory IX, described him in a manifesto. "Out of the sea comes a beast filled with words of blasphemy, which, formed with the feet of a bear, the mouth of an enraged lion, and in the rest of its body shaped like a panther, opens its mouth in blasphemy of the divine name." Examine closely the head, the torso, and the extremities of this beast, the so-called emperor, this creator of lives, oblivious to all modesty, untouched by the blush of shame, a wolf in sheep's clothing, blustering in greatness and intoxicated with power, a scorpion with a sting in its tail.
Sounds like the monotheistic god.
By contrast, Friedrich Nietzsche calls him that great free spirit, a genius among German emperors, Frederick II. Nietzsche compares him to Alcibiades, Julius Caesar, and Leonardo da Vinci, and calls him the first European to my own taste. So, which version of Frederick II are we to choose? The evil monster of Pope Frederick IX, or the great free spirit of Friedrich Nietzsche? I leave it to you to decide.
Of course, she'll put you up and then we can make a very